Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we can certainly reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Today, I thought I would start by reading letters from readers to the editor of the Good Old Days magazine. Here are some letters that answer the question, do you have a memory of the fish that got away? What about the person who taught you to fish? Or what your favorite fishing hole was like? Now, here are some of the answers. Here's a letter from Sharon Jones of Reno, Nevada. She says, my daddy was a fly fisherman, and we spent our annual family vacation at a campsite on the banks of the Matolius River in Oregon. We had a little teardrop trailer for sleeping, but our days were spent outside. For breakfast, we had fresh rainbow trout from the river and eggs and fried potatoes, all cooked over the campfire. For lunch, we had the same. For dinner, we had rainbow trout, corn on the cob, and fried potatoes. Politically correct diet or not, I have still never had any food that tasted as good. So says Sharon Jones of Reno, Nevada. And here's a letter from Bernie Eisworth of Montgomery, Alabama. When we were young, my brother Gary took me to the local discount center to purchase a starter fishing rod. We found one for only $2.99 that came with all I needed, rod and reel, hooks, bob, and sinkers. Years later, we had a yard sale, and a young lady came up to me to buy the rod for her son. She asked, did you catch any fish with this rod? I replied, if your son catches as many fish with it as I did, you'd better like eating fish. She handed me $5. This was from Bernie Eisworth of Montgomery, Alabama. Now a letter from Orville Pierce of Pensacola, Florida. I grew up in Miami, Oklahoma, in the late 1940s through the early 60s. My grandparents lived in Vinita, Oklahoma, 35 miles away. They shared a boathouse on Grand Lake of the Cherokees, where they often fished. We would also go across the Pensacola Dam to Disney, Oklahoma, to get bait and fish the dam's spillway. One day, the spillway was brisk. However, there were no fish. As we started to pack up, my rod began to bounce. I set the hook, and Granddad went to get our catch. He laughed as he held up only a big carp head. I was a sad 10-year-old. This was Orville Pierce of Pensacola, Florida. And finally, this letter. When I was 7 or 8 and the oldest of 4 kids growing up in the late 1940s, it was rare that I had any alone time with my grandparents. However, one day, my Spofford grandparents took me fishing with them. I felt very special being in that boat with them. One of them baited the pole they gave me to fish with. But when they instructed me to throw the line in, That's what I did. I threw the line in, the pole, and all. Needless to say, that was my one and only fishing trip with my grandparents. This was sent in by Judy Sargent of Auburn, Maine. This next story will give you a kind of an introduction to what you'll be hearing on the good old days for the next several weeks. The article is entitled, Remembering Holidays. Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas in Brooklyn style were great times for this family. This was sent in by Crystal Gnett Komen. Individual recollections of family traditions never seem to get old to me. It's fascinating that these traditions are so often closely tied to where and when people grew up and how long they'd lived in America. In my family, my parents were the first generation born in this country, making me part of the second wave. During my mother's formative years, the neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, in the 1930s and 40s, consisted of mostly immigrants and naturalized citizens. German, Polish, Slavic, those were the languages and accents one often heard. Transportation out of the neighborhood was mostly by subway, a bus here and there, and your own walking feet. Relatives lucky enough to afford a car could visit, but people mostly stayed within their own hamlet of a new life. So, too, did the customs, foods, and traditions they brought with them from the old country, especially during the holidays. As the second-generation Americans, like me, began to be born, people had, quote, married into the neighborhood, but not too much changed in the 1950s. The houses back then were called six-family railroad flats, with each apartment having four rooms. The kitchen was always at the back of the house nearest the yard, and the front room, we never called it a living room, was at the front of the house by the street. Most houses contained extended members of the same family. Some of the wives worked outside of the home. My grandmother was proudly a sewing machine operator of the time. Still, there was always someone home to watch children, cook dinner, and basically be in charge of the neighborhood. This was Brooklyn, so it's important to remember that all the houses were attached to one another, each having a large stoop with black wrought iron railings in the front. Each house often became known by the name of the original family that lived there. Ours was the Sturzer House, and my friend Janet's house was the Bolin House, and so on. There wasn't a mom or a grandma who didn't know all the kids on the block. This shared knowledge did much to keep the neighborhood discipline under check. All of this helped to shape the holidays. In my mother's time, Halloween was not a holiday that was readily celebrated. Many European immigrants brought with them long-held superstitions that put a kibosh on the American version of Halloween. No one ever went out after dark in the Heimatland, or homeland, on October 31st, as that was when all the evil spirits roamed loose. That's one of the reasons why November 1st, All Saints' Day, was the holiday of choice, religious or otherwise. By the time my generation came along, beliefs had softened somewhat. We could enjoy box costume sets with masks, as well as pumpkins, bobbing for apples, and scary decorations. One year, my parents surprised us by turning our apartment into a spook house. It was great. Even my grandmother had fun hiding behind a front room chair with a mask on. But we still didn't go outside after dark to go trick-or-treating. Instead, we went from floor to floor inside our building asking for candy. Thanksgiving was very different between generations, too. Perhaps because of being Depression-era babies as kids, when my mom was young, she and her friends would dress up as hobos right after school and go from door to door asking, "Anything for Thanksgiving?" Families still got together for special meals, but these were more closely tied to foods associated with their heritage, rather than the American version of turkey with all the trimmings. By the time I came along, turkey was it, but the side dishes, thankfully, were still very much culturally inspired. We still hold on to those dishes today. I never lost my admiration for my tiny grandmother, who did it all by herself, including desserts for our hungry family who would crowd into her small kitchen. Most times the turkey was so heavy she needed help to lift it. Many years later, I tried to do it all by myself like she did and nearly collapsed into my plate from exhaustion. Christmas had to be different. Part of the immigrant experience of that time meant that our grandparents had left most of their immediate family behind. Some were lucky to have had a brother or sister come over with them. So in my mom's day, times were hard, and extended family was sometimes scarce. But they did always find a way to celebrate. If there was a tree, it was a real one. It was always put up on Christmas Eve, and not taken down before the Feast of the Three Kings. The day bubble lights came into use must have seemed like modern times. Presents, if there were any, were practical and sometimes included food. Toys or playthings were scarce, but if received, they were cherished. The Christmases of my youth must have seemed so different to my parents and my grandparents. They worked so hard to make more of it for us than what they had. Christmas Eve, tree trimming was still the same, though bubble lights were replaced by the multicolored large bulb sets. Tinsel, and later garland, made everything sparkle. Of course, we made plenty of paper chains and always included ornaments we had made in school. I still have some of them on my tree today. There was always a nativity set under the tree. Even if our cats were not necessarily gentle with it, we followed the same routine we had on Halloween, going from floor to floor, which gave us three times to open presents. But all had to be done in time for midnight mass. I know we received more toys than my parents had, but they weren't extravagant by today's standards. Sometimes it seemed that our grandparents splurged the most on us, and they seemed so happy with our displays of delight. One memorable splurge was my wonderful roller skates. Yes, the ones with the key that you wore around your neck. Roller skating on Brooklyn streets was great, but I was never quite able to master that skill on a rink. Go figure. I never told my mother, but when Santa brought those skates, I took the nativity figures for rides on the skates, of course, when no one was looking. As years move on, changes are inevitable. Elders are no longer with us, and families grow large and scatter far and wide. Some of the traditions we had could never be the same now, but those we hold on to and pass down to each next generation are as important as when they began with our family's first steps in our new country. And this was Remembering Holidays by Crystal Kinnett Conan. Now, here's a special treat from the Good Old Days magazine, and I'll read to you what the editor says about it. She says, Good Old Days is mostly filled with nostalgic stories from the past. But in this issue, we have a special treat. Annie's Fiction, Good Old Days' sister company, is producing a feature-length film of one of its suspense novels. And we have the scoop. It's entitled Guilty Secrets, A Mystery Comes to Life in the Midwest. Many of the stories featured in Good Old Days happen in small towns across the country. In these places, life is idyllic, the pace is relaxed, and neighbors wave to each other. These are the types of towns where daily life goes on as expected. But much more is brewing in these small towns. Lights, camera, even murder. In Harrison, Ohio, a charming town in the southern part of the state, the town's quiet streets were the backdrop to a thrilling romantic suspense movie that filmed there this past spring. The movie, based on the novel Guilty Secrets from Annie's Fiction, finds new attorney Riley Carrigan landing in this small town to start a new job. When Riley discovers a dusty box of old cases, she realizes her mother's best friend from high school might have been wrongly convicted of murder 25 years ago. Riley is now on a mission to prove her innocence, but in doing so, discovers sinister agendas that could put her life in danger. Luckily, Scott Stackhouse, the handsome grandson of the law firm's owner, helps her unearth the truth, and in doing so, the two find they work well together in more ways than one. For 12 days, professional camera and light setups popped up all around town. Harrison's old brick buildings and quaint main streets became the movie sets. Turning the novel into a film is a joint venture between executive producers Annie's and Josh Mass. The production company, One Choice Productions, is based out of Los Angeles. Director Lindsay Hartley, also a producer along with John Katzman, is an actress who has directed 20 features. Lindsay was drawn to the novel because of its mix of mystery and romance. And it's that blend of heartfelt relationships and spine-tingling suspense that makes Guilty Secrets so compelling. Lindsay also plays one of the main characters, Patty. Kyla Nova plays Riley. Doug Noble plays Scott. Brian Scott Childers plays Tucker. And Dee Wallace plays Lynn. The feature-length film will be available to stream in the fall, but Good Old Days readers can get a sneak peek now. At GuiltySecretsMovie.com, you can learn more about the movie and read the first two chapters for free. It's true that small towns hold secrets, and Harrison, Ohio is one of them. And here is an excerpt from that book. Tuesday, May 14th, 1996. If the second hand on the wall clock over the cash register hadn't been moving, Linda Turpin would have sworn the batteries had died. It was 2:37 in the morning. She indulged in a huge gaping yawn that she didn't bother to cover. What was the point? The convenience store was empty except for her. "It's my own fault," she spoke aloud, a habit she'd picked up whenever she worked the midnight shift. "I promised myself I wouldn't pull a double that involves an overnight, and now here I am." Linda had almost refused the last-minute request to fill in tonight, but the extra money would come in handy. The payments for her new car were putting a bigger strain on her finances than she had expected. Besides, it was always a good idea to go the extra mile. If she ever found a better job, she would need references. Her eyelids felt as though they had weights attached to them. If she didn't do something to keep herself busy, she was going to fall asleep right here at the checkout counter. She had already swept the aisles and cleaned the glass on the doors of the refrigerated section. The afternoon shift had restocked the shelves, so that didn't need to be done. Linda rounded the counter and wandered down the first aisle. Whoever did the stocking hadn't been too particular about neatness. Finally, something to do. She set about straightening the merchandise, pulling bags of chips to the front of the metal pegs, and rearranging candy bars in their boxes. The second aisle seemed okay, but in the last aisle, the one in the rear of the store, the small selection of grocery items had been shoved on the bottom shelf with no regard to order at all. She dropped to her knees and began lining up the cans in even rows. A car engine rumbled outside. Linda was glad there was a customer at last. She stood and started toward the register. As she glanced through the storefront window, she froze. A youngish man with long, unkempt hair hanging halfway down his back sat behind the wheel. His wrinkled T-shirt bore the logo of a rock band, and it had a big hole in one of the sleeves. But what caught her attention was the object in his hand, a gun, which he shoved into the waistband of his jeans. Linda dropped to her haunches behind the cover of the shelving unit. The store was about to be robbed, and she was here alone and defenseless. Outside, a car door slammed shut. Then another. There were two of them. Her pulse pounding like a drum, Linda frantically scanned the store. Was there anything within reach that she could use as a weapon? In the next instant, she bit back a hysterical laugh. She could lob cans of chili and beef stew at them. No, what she needed was a telephone. She'd never get to the one at the checkout counter in time. But there was a phone in the office. Linda eyed the rear of the store. The short hallway leading to the restrooms was about 20 feet away. At the end of that hallway was the stockroom, and in there was the office. The bell over the front door chimed. The robbers were inside the store. Linda checked the rounded mirror mounted in the back corner. From the register, the clerk on duty could see nearly everywhere in the store. It was helpful for catching shoplifters, but at the moment it provided a terrifying view of the man and woman who had just entered the building. If they looked up, they would spot her. They looked up. With her breath caught in her chest, Linda bolted toward the stockroom. "Grab her!" the woman shouted. The man dashed down the aisle after her. Linda reached the restroom hallway and threw herself forward. She grasped the doorknob to the stockroom and twisted. It didn't move. The door was locked, and the key was next to the cash register at the front of the store. The man grabbed a handful of her hair and jerked her backward. He put his lips close to her ear. His breath reeked of liquor. "Where do you think you're going?" He gave an ugly laugh. The sound sent a chill down her spine. He whirled them both around, and Linda saw that the woman had joined them in the short hallway. She held a baseball bat in one hand. "We have a message for you," she said. Something hard and cold pressed into Linda's side. She knew it was the gun. She also knew she was about to die. Now here's a Q&A with the author, Lindsay Hartley. What drew you to this story? Answer: What captivated me about Guilty Secrets was its blend of gripping suspense, subtle romance, and the quaint charm of a small town backdrop. The intricate layers of the cold case storyline seamlessly blended with the intimate backdrop, weaving a rich and cinematic tapestry that not only kept me eagerly engaged until the final page, but also ignited a desire to translate that immersive experience into visual reality. Why did you want to work with Annie's? Answer: What drew me to Annie's was a combination of my passion for crafting, sense of community, and love for reading. Annie's books and patterns provide endless inspiration for new projects, making Annie's a delightful hub that combines my favorite hobbies and interests seamlessly. You are such a creative person. Are there any crafts you enjoy when you have the time? As a craft enthusiast at heart, I've always been drawn to creative endeavors. From crafting dried rose trees with my mother to embellishing projects with glitter and rhinestones, I find joy in adding a touch of sparkle to everything I do. My passion for crafting extends beyond personal projects. It's a shared bond between my daughter and me. Together we craft jewelry, decorate and paint wooden objects for various holidays, creating cherished memories while honing our artistic skills. In this movie, new attorney Riley Kerrigan finds herself mixed up in a murder cold case involving a close friend. What piece of advice would you give her to help solve the mystery? My advice would be to go to the police. But let's be honest, that would make for an incredibly boring story. And that's our program for today. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.